AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
What up, you beauties? This episode is brought to you by Top Cheese Hockey Wax, trusted by players and greasy pigeons everywhere who take their game seriously. Head to topcheesehockeywax.com and use code PIGEON10 at checkout to get 10% off your order. Top Cheese Hockey Wax. Grip it and rip it. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Greasy Pigeon Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Sullivan. With me, as always, there he is, sporting the red because he's all about the blue and white from Toronto right about now. Good old Kevin Trusser. Kevin, how you feeling after game two?
Feeling good. You know, Pops is happy. So, yeah, we'll see what happens on the road down at Sunrise. But the Leafs right now, they're looking strong. If they can take one or two, you know, you never know.
Absolutely.
But that's a team that can blow leads. As we know.
And that's the most NHL playoff talk you're going to get for this episode today, because quite frankly, I don't want to talk about the Maple Leafs. So we're not going to. So moving right along to our guest, our guest has joined us, and I got a ton of questions to ask him. And he's sitting on a mountain of knowledge in the youth hockey space. Our guest today is Jim Haverstrom. Jim is known locally to a lot of hockey people. He's been in Florida a long time. He's got a 25-year career within youth hockey in multiple states, a lot of it being in Florida. He's the current USA Hockey coach in chief for, I believe that's the Florida district or the Southeast district, however that's broken down. Jim, I will absolutely let you correct me in a second. He is also a coach developer for USA Hockey, works with training the new coaches, guys like me who need to learn the game. He does his best to try to give me the knowledge I need to coach the youth. And he also devotes his time on the ice with the Tampa Bay Hockey Club out of Oldsmar. Not only helps them with their program, but also helps coach. I believe this year it's the 8 and 10 U's really develop the USA Hockey development model in those children, get them having fun, get them to love the game. But Jim, so glad you could take a few minutes to talk some hockey with us. So thank you and welcome to the Pigeon's Nest.
Well, thanks for having me on. I've listened to a bunch of your different episodes and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. See, Kev, we have a fan. So,
hang on. He didn't say total fans, but yeah.
True. He just listens. He doesn't say he likes them. So, Jim, like I said in the intro, you've been involved in youth hockey for about 25 years per your bio, right? And you've seen the landscape in a bunch of different states. I'm curious just to start off with, what do you think, how have you seen the landscape of youth hockey change, especially in a non-traditional market like Florida?
I mean, what's happened, especially in Florida, with the number of teams, I mean, we always had a bunch of East Coast and minor league teams. Now we're having two NHL teams that are really successful. We're seeing a blossoming of programs, a number of more kids that want to play, a little more interest. Parents who may not have thought about playing hockey for their kids getting swept up with, you know, all the emotions of winning Stanley Cups. So we're seeing a tremendous growth in the younger ages, for sure.
Yeah, to piggyback off of that, obviously Florida over the past 5 years, having an NHL squad representing in the Stanley Cup final. I think the challenge that we've talked about previously is there enough rinks? Is there enough time for these kids to be able to get on the ice and develop those skills and introduce the game to those that want to learn it? What's your take on, you know, where we're at in the area as an area of Tampa Bay and state of Florida as a whole?
Well, I agree with you. We can always use more rinks, but I also think we can utilize our ice a lot better. There's this idea that we need so much full ice when actually we don't need to be having so many practices where a 10U team has a full ice. I see it as a recruiting tool. We're going to practice full ice. Well, me as a coach who does 10U and specializes in the way I train, it's almost like I don't need that ice. And I have to find creative ways to make you think I'm using that ice when I don't necessarily need that full sheet of ice. So then we could have more teams on the ice. I know that when I worked for the Florida Panthers, our rec program, they practiced twice a week. All the coaches that were on the ice were our rec, were our travel coaches, and I designed every program so that way we could get even our rec kids on the ice twice a week. So they were only on the ice one less day than our travel teams were. But again, we do need more rinks, but we also need to utilize them better and not think that we have to almost take away ice time opportunities for other kids by having kids on the ice, full ice all the time.
Yeah, and that ties in, I think, with that USA Hockey model that they really started to reinforce, you know, what, decade plus ago, about the small area games and multiple touches, you know, kind of taking hockey away from the whiteboard and the arrows to more of a feel and giving them the ability to grow the skill. And you're seeing that in the NHL now for the American players, right? Especially we saw it in the World Juniors, where the newer next generation of superstars are so much skill, you know, there's so much skill there. And that's already in the NHL. Trevor Zegras comes to mind, obviously Austin Matthews for different reasons, right? But the skill is there across every country, but the USA really seems to be hammering it home at the youth level. And I'm just curious, Jim, if you could speak for a minute on kind of we've talked about it before on the show, where what's the role of USA Hockey for what matters to our parents, right? We all know that we all go on and pay the money, the extra 65 or 70 bucks to get a USA Hockey number, right? Okay, yippee skippy. What does that really mean? And unless you're a coach and you go through those coaching classes, or you are on a team with a coach like Kevin, who takes the time to explain to parents preseason what the goals are, the missions and the values and the vision of the team's going to be, a lot of parents just see their kids doing stupid things on a half sheet of ice at 10U and go, what am I wasting my money for? Right. So can you take a few minutes, Jim, and walk our listening audience through what USA Hockey is trying to do, especially at the 8, 10, even 12U level, that gets them ready to be the player that every parent wants their kid to be when they get older?
That's a great question, Jeffrey. So we're even going away from USA Hockey, away from what the original ADM model was, where you had six stations and kids are going around cones because, oh, they got a lot of touches and all that kind of stuff. What we're trying to do now is create situational touches. We're trying to create problem solvers, even at 8U. And the idea that you have to learn, you have to be able to stick handle like this, you have to be able to pass like this, you have to be able to skate like this before you can actually start playing is a misnomer. We can teach kids these different skills while they're still in game situations and playing, kind of. Like, I don't think any of you guys, when you were younger, if you went outside to go play hockey at 7 and they said, hey, we're going to bring a bunch of cones and you got to do this first and you got to pass back and forth to each other, you would either beat up the kid who brought the cones or you would have gone home. So we professionalized it and put it in an adult model where, okay, they have to do this before they can do that. So like what I do with my 8Us and stuff, everything turns out into some sort of game. Even if it's a race, even if it's a skating thing, I might do skating drills where they have to keep their skates on the ice, but they're playing a game. So they decide whether they're going to do a swizzle. They're going to decide whether they're going to do a 1 foot push. I'm finding kids who all of a sudden doing a spinorama who, if I have that as a drill, they can't do it. But if they see it, that's the only way I'm going to get away from this guy. I'm going to do it. And, you know, so it's going to be a messier thing. The biggest thing with USA Hockey is we're really trying to design even or create more problem-solving athletes. Because like you said, we're getting really skillful. But even people like Wayne Gretzky says, I don't know if we're getting smarter. So we want to start getting that idea of having this incredible toolkit of these technical abilities. But can I use it when the game is actually being played? And my pet peeve is Instagram. When I see a lot of, you know, solo guys going, and then the drill says it's about, this is an evasion drill. We're trying to learn how to get away from somebody, and they're getting away from a cone, or a deception drill on a cone. Well, it's really easy to deceive a cone because a cone doesn't react. So let's take that game and play it against another player, even at 8U, even at 7U. Maybe I'm going to give him a little more time before the defender gets on him so that he has more time to do that, but he's still playing against a defender. I like to play ringette a lot with younger kids because their heads are up and now they'll start being, everything that they're doing is based off what they are seeing. Unfortunately, if we go into a lot of rinks, that's not always what we see. Parents like clean, not messy stuff. So, and they also like seeing, oh, I see my son got better today or my daughter got better, but they got better at what? The drill? Or did they get better at playing hockey? And that's what USA Hockey is really pushing through in all our education program.
Yeah, Jim, you make an interesting point. And Jeff, you know this just from, us coaching together. I was always a big believer of, look, you have to have the fundamentals, right? But you also have to have fun. And, growing up, there were kids that looked fantastic skating around cones, and they would make it to the next cut. But when they started to get into exhibition games and when you're playing the actual game, there was zero hockey sense whatsoever. I love to hear the fact that USA Hockey is going, building off of the model that they had. I was a firm believer in the small area games, even some of the cones, right? We just talking to the kids when I was on the ice, hey, what does that cone represent? As opposed to it, being a player, but to introduce a defender into that, I used to put myself in that or have another coach put themselves into that to make it more real. But the hockey sense, if we can continue to build on that, because the skill level of these kids, it's ridiculous. What they can do with the puck and what they can do skating is unbelievable. But we also know that you sit and watch the playoffs. What happens? It's a small area. Whoever wins that battle or whoever breaks down that battle, that turns into a scoring chance, and that's the game right there. So it's awesome to hear that you guys are building off of that, because firm believer in it. Small area games, make it fun, make it competitive. Let the kids choose as they get older too, as to what games they'd like to play, and keeping score with it, right? They want to beat their buddies. They want to beat their friends out there. And, the more compete level that you can have your practices, and it just makes it better, as a whole. So that's fantastic to hear.
And we're not just playing games to play games. Like, we'll have games like a Royal Road game. If you pass across the Royal Road and you score, it's 3 points. If you score any way you can, that's 1 point, because we don't want you standing in front of the net and not take a shot. That's not realistic. So, or we'll do games where we want to have more tip-ins. So now a tip-in goal or a rebound goal is three points as opposed to one. And like you said, Kevin, my team's kept score all year, and we also had a little game clock. It went to a certain time because that's what the game does. There'd be times I might let it go a little further, but they didn't know that necessarily. But it would be like, this is when it's over. You got to learn how to play with the pressure of there's only 30 seconds left to go and you're up by one goal.
To go off a of ringette too, it warms my heart, because I was a big proponent of the ringette rings. When I started coaching 8U, 10U, I would bring those out, and you should have seen some of the parents, specifically down here in Florida, looking at me like I had two heads. And like you said, it has them keeping their head up. It's easier to control the, specifically at the younger level, right? But just a different dynamic for them to be able to work with that. And working with tennis balls and street hockey balls, and as they got older, we'd fire some golf balls out there or lacrosse balls and make it real fun. You got to make it challenging, because the game is all about reading and reacting. Not that football doesn't read and react, but there's a lot of set plays and then it's done. To be able to do things on the fly and change, stop and start is huge. So no, again, that is great to hear, because I've been out of the coaching game for 2 years.
Yeah, and when we teach skating, we need to teach it in the way that they're going to play a game. So the idea that, great, if you can do a crossover, that's fantastic, but can you do a quarter of a crossover? Can you do a full crossover, then into a quarter of a crossover, and do a tight turn based off of what you see, as opposed to this looks really good?
So, Jim, I'm curious, right? So you spend a lot of time in other states, right? You mentioned Colorado, Texas, Tennessee. They're Colorado probably less so than the others, but they're all pretty much non-traditional hockey markets. They're not what you would think of bread and butter hockey universe.
Yeah, so Colorado's still kind of non-traditional because there really aren't as many hockey arenas as you'd expect. It just happens to be cold there in the winter. But Dallas area is very similar to Florida. Tennessee, Nashville for sure is very similar to Florida. What they just don't have that Florida has is that these different pockets. Like in Texas, you have Austin. There's like a program there. There's some in Houston, but Dallas is your main area. And I would say Dallas is very similar to all the different markets that we have here in Florida, like South Florida and Central Florida and the Tampa area.
So you're seeing then with that same, but I would say, so the Dallas Stars program, the Junior Stars is a perennial really good top 25 team in the country. How have they been able to turn to maybe get a higher level of hockey player at a youth age versus the Florida, Miami, Tampa area? Is it just number of volume? Is it that kids stay home, or is it they're just pulling kids from all over the country and they're playing in Dallas?
It's a combination. What's different in Texas is each organization can only have two teams at every age, at every, whether it's 10 under, 12 under. So if a kid who's a first year 10U makes the 10UA team, they don't go searching for a double A team, because the double A teams have already tried out the week before, and then the A teams try out after that. So it's almost like it's expected. If I'm first year, I'm going to play A, and that's okay with people. And I think, and they also then have a pretty robust house league program because the Stars run it, and the Stars manage all the rinks, and obviously they want to keep all their ice filled. So they do a really good job with keeping, you know, kids playing rec so they don't fall behind. So I think that that model does help. There may be less teams to play on for sure, but there's always the safety net of kids playing rec, which is not a bad thing. And I think that rec gets a bad name only because I don't think all the programs, like when I work for the Panthers, there aren't many programs that are going to be willing to put five travel coaches out there on the ice. But the Panthers were willing to do it because they wanted to see the program be successful and grow. So I think that's where Texas has an advantage. Also, the program I ran also had a tier one part to it too. It didn't get to be tier one the next year because we didn't meet the qualifications. The state, or Taha, had, this is what a tier one program needed to have. You had to be ranked within such and such. You had to supply off ice. You had to supply this. You had to supply that. So there was a standard that you had to meet, and you had to reapply. Even the Dallas Stars elite had to reapply every so many years. So then you were, then there was, I think is what we're doing now with Seehoff, with the idea that we're going to set a standard that people have to apply to, as opposed to creating our own teams. Because you can't set a standard if you have your own teams. They don't have to reapply. So I think that's one of the things that Texas did well. And the same with, and they have to travel too, just like everybody else, like we do. When I was in Colorado, there was only so many travel teams, tier one teams allowed too, but we could play, there were four of us that we could, you know, play within each other. You know, you could play 20 games right there in Colorado, which was nice. And then everybody else, of course, played your other 30 or 40 other games, either through scrimmages or you played them through, you know, going to these major tournaments like everybody else does.
So you mentioned, you know, I've had the privilege of being in Texas to go for my level four. And I was just, you know, amazed with how involved the Stars were with all the rinks that were there. Everyone that was coaching out there, they were wearing Dallas Stars, you know, warm-ups. In Colorado, did the Avalanche have the same impact or same involvement as what Texas did? And, you know, we'll touch on Florida because it sounds like the pro teams are finally dipping into the market here as well. What can you say about that there, Jim?
The Avalanche, what they see, the difference with the Stars is they have a financial investment. They manage those rinks. So they actually have rinks that they can, they control, in a sense that where when they first got there, there were a proliferation of travel organizations, and they actually helped scale that down so there weren't so many, so the quality was better. In Colorado, involvement with the Avalanche, besides obviously the Learn to Play programs, was more of that they had a Pee Wee tournament they did every year that sent the winner from that Pee Wee division, Pee Wee AA, to Quebec, and they sponsored the team. They gave them the outfits. They paid in. So it was kind of a neat. One of our tournaments we went to was, if you won this, you get to go to Pee Wee Quebec. So that's where their involvement was at the time that I was there. They're not involved on the youth hockey scene as far as running rinks or that aspect of it.
We take this brief TV timeout. We want to tell you about something new with the Greasy Pigeon Podcast. Head on over to greasypigeonpodcast.bigcartel.com. That's greasypigeonpodcast.bigcartel.com. That's where you can find our merch. The GPP OG golf hat that I'm wearing, the vinyl sticker for your mug, your laptop, the signpost, your helmet, your dad's back window of his car, whatever it takes, you can find it all there and more to come. We're just getting started. Head on over to greasypigeonpodcast.bigcartel.com. Come get your gear now. From the rink to the links, look your best. Let's get back to the show. So let's bring that home to Florida, right? So I'm sure you're familiar. Recently, there's been some hubbub, to say the least. regarding Seehof in tier one and tier two. Let's start with what you mentioned a second ago and what I'm calling the decentralization of tier one, right? So you mentioned it, Seehof had the Florida Alliance and for next season, they still will. And then from that point forward, it is being basically taken away from Seehof, or Seehof is stepping back, I think is a better way to put that, right? We know about Longwood and the Florida Surf coming into the tier one program. That's an, I'll call them an independent organization that's bringing a tier one team into Seehof. The Alliance is going to have to become something different to, you know, to keep that sort of structure, if you want to think of it that way, to have a second tier one team, or someone's going to have to start it, Nest Hockey, or pick your other person, right, that wants to start a new program at tier one level. Jim, can you break down maybe a little more detail, a little more eloquently than I just did, on what is kind of happening with that issue with Seehof and the Alliance?
Yeah, I mean, there's a moratorium from USA Hockey anyway on tier one programs. So other being the programs that were the Alliance would be grandfathered in. But Seehof has decided, and I'm on the Seehof board, but I'm a non-voting member because I'm the coach in chief. I'm a USA Hockey appointee. So I was involved with some of those meetings. And we just think that Seehof would be better off not running the teams, instead setting what the standards should be. You actually, I think, have more say in direction that way, because now you can say, like in Texas, these are the things that you need to provide to be a tier one team. So, and I think that's really important. My son was a coach with the 18 Alliance in the South this year. I mean, and they had a different program than the North. They practiced 3 days a week at one location. So that's different than a weekend model, you know, so I think it'll be better if the pro teams get involved. I know that I worked for the Panthers, but one time we were looking to do tier one a few years ago. They are very excited about trying to get into tier one. I think the Lightning are also, and I think that's nothing against any other programs. I think that's a good thing because there's a lot of expertise that they can bring in. There's a little cachet to playing for their names. It doesn't mean that you can't have a third one like the Florida Surf. My biggest concern for all of them is as long as they are truly a program, because as we know, in a sense, and this isn't a knock on the Alliance, it was more like individual teams as opposed to this is the way every single team's going to do it. And I know that because when my son was a coach, you know, this had to be exactly this way. And I think that with the introduction of going through these NHL bound teams and with Longwood, there'll be more of a program structure, which I think is something that was sorely missing. I think that the Alliance did the best they could at the time. Seehof, the best interest of all the programming was for them to step back and be a regulator as opposed to actually running programs. There was not necessarily a program with the Alliance. I think everybody did the best they could, but each team separately ran as its own entity. Off-ice at one rink could be CrossFit, and off-ice at another one could be working with a specialized trainer. Down south, where my son was coaching the U18 team, or the 18U team, I mean, is they practiced 3 days a week. They didn't have to do a weekend model. So each area had its benefits and its deficits, but now if the teams get involved, they'll be the ones setting the standards. Do I think that they'll still need some help from people who are involved with youth hockey? Yes, because there's a big difference between running an NHL franchise and running a youth hockey program. But I think there's a lot of smart people that want to get involved, that want to see what's really good for hockey in Florida. Having three programs won't be a problem. They'll play against each other. Is there a question about whether we have as much skill to have high-end Tier 1 teams? I don't really know the answer because every age group is different. I mean, every birth year is different. And tier one is not what tier one was when I ran a program in Colorado, because there weren't as many tier one teams. So the level was higher. People didn't mind playing AA hockey as much at that time. And junior hockey wasn't taking over the market so much, where kids who are playing, you know, tier one or tier three, second level, you know, junior hockey at 16 instead of playing triple or AA hockey and stuff. And I'm not saying it's good or bad. It's just a different market, you know? So I think that it's going to help hockey in this area. Will kids still leave? You better believe they'll leave, because they'll always think that this is a better thing for my family. And that's okay. My kid left because it was a weekend model. I had two other boys. Like, there was no way every weekend we're going to be able to take, just worry about one son, and they all played hockey. So it was an easier life for him, or more semi-normal life, to move to Colorado, live with a family, go to high school normally, practice 3 days a week, and fly together with his team everywhere, as opposed to going from this airport and that airport. So hopefully, with this idea of centralizing these teams, there will be less disruption of families' lives. We'll see how it all works out, because one advantage the Panthers may have is they own or run two facilities, and the Lightning don't. But so they'll have to get a buy-in from the different rinks in the area, which I'm pretty confident they'll be able to do.
Therein lies the million-dollar question. Everyone being able to play nice together and provide ice so that we can grow the game and not price the game out. You know, that's the biggest difference that I've seen, specifically growing up in Canada, where a lot of the rinks at the time when I was there, you know, they were government run. So you were not able to go, you know, to another area if you were zoned to play in a certain, you know, municipality where you're at. With the state of hockey, with Florida right now and the state of hockey, where do you see them stacking up to, specifically with your experience in Texas and Colorado, and you mentioned Tennessee? Where do you see it going moving forward in Florida? Like, do you see it continuing to grow in non-traditional areas of the state? Is there talk about that? Because we all know that, you know, the Tampa Bay area, Fort Myers, obviously you got down south in Palm Beach and Sunrise, where the Panthers play. Orlando was always a market I thought that they could have more, you know, more rinks in, more players coming from.
Yeah, the issue with Orlando was, and I was the hockey director at RDV for 10 years, is the lack of facilities. And it's expensive to run an ice rink. I mean, the main reason that rink was built, beautiful RDV, was because the Orlando Solar Bears and Rich DeVos wanted a training area for his team. And it was the help way. It was a great way to recruit players in the old IHL, which was a lot of ex-NHL players and stuff like that. RDV has a huge rec league. So now their travel programs are also competing with ice with their rec leagues. Building facilities are not cheap. So that is an issue. And when I was at RDV, we had a birth years from 91 to 93, where we had one kid make the NHL, a couple of kids make the AHL and other leagues. And a bunch of them played D1 or D3 or played USHL or NAHL. So we had a core of kids who grew up playing against each other every day at skate and shoot that made them the players that they were going to be. It wasn't the practices we were running. It was, you know, all that other stuff that they did. But again, Florida hockey's, if we do our best to try to get away from this idea that individualized training is the end all and give our kids situational playing, making them problem solvers with the technique that they have, we are going to become a major player in the United States. There's no doubt in my mind. It used to be, I know, because like I said, I started in this business in 2000. At the squirt level, our teams could go play anybody and beat anybody because we could skate as well or faster and we could handle pucks better. We got into trouble around 14 when you had to think the game. You couldn't just get away now with being the best stick handler or the best, you know. So now if we adjust our practices where we're making problem solvers, I don't think there's anything that would really hold us back.
What's the buy-in from the coaching, the coaches, the current coaches that are coming in with that? Because that is always the struggle, right? Is, you know, they're thinking, is the juice worth the squeeze, so to speak? They knew what made them successful. And even with those that didn't play, you've got mom and dad in their ear constantly telling them what they should be doing because they're watching practice. Is the buy-in there? Are you seeing that? I'm hoping that's the case.
I'm seeing more buy-in. And that's one of my jobs with TBHC is I'm working with their coaches to help them with that. Show them how, if I'm asking them what is it they see that your team is deficient at? And if they say, well, they're not good at doing this or they're not doing good at that, we're not getting shots to the net, okay, so what are you doing? And then how can we just do this better? How can we make this more game-like? And so it's hard work for the coaches because it's not that they can just think about what they did. They have to become what we want to call architectural and environmental architects as opposed to drill designers. I know that's a fancy way of putting it, but like I said, my team wasn't good at tip-ins. So now I'm going to develop a game where they're doing tip-ins. And so we just got to get, it's harder for some of the older coaches because, and I'm an old coach, I'm 65, but it's the whole idea is how can we just do this better? And yes, I was successful doing it the other way. We created some good players. But do we create those players in spite of us or because of us is what I'm trying to, you know, we've got to figure out sometimes. And I think what earlier Jeff said about you, Kevin, communication with our parents is paramount. We owe it to them. We got to look at them not as adversaries, but as some people that we can help educate. And I don't mean like looking down as that I do it basically, if I run a practice, I write to tell the parents, this is why we did this. This is why we played tag. This is why we played ringette. This is why we played this game. This, I noticed we were missing this in practice because they deserve to know. And they also, you know, and I remember when I was working for the Panthers, I was coaching, training the 8Us, and I had Joe Thornton in the class. His kid, not in the class. Joe Thornton's kid was in the program. And I remember I wrote an email to the families, and Joe said, I never read my emails, but I read that one. It's really good. Do you think you really need to do it? And I go, Joe, I don't need to do it for you, but I need to do it for all the other parents who don't understand what we're doing or think what we're doing is just playing with no intention behind it. And so our younger, our other coaches have to be willing to also make mistakes, because you are going to make mistakes doing this stuff, but to learn to adjust to it and realize that, hey, this didn't work because of what reason? Was the area too big? Was the area too small? Did I have too many guys on the ice? You know, that kind of stuff. And it's going to be a learning curve for them, but the resources are there for them to help anybody who has questions in how to do it.
So let me ask you a question then. So we're in the middle of tryout season, and I do want to ask you in a second to kind of, you know, not reveal too much behind the curtain as far as TBHC goes, but I am curious to know how tryouts looked and what the week was like for TBHC. But before we get to that, we always talk about skill development, right? Go in the driveway and shoot 100 pucks a day and you know, go out and play roller hockey or skate or go play soccer or lacrosse, right? Something that's cross-functional, that extra sport in the summer, in the off season or during the season, if it doesn't get in the way, right? Depending what age you are, what level you play, do something different. With the way you're talking about the game evolving and the way we're coaching the game evolving, do players have to do different prep off the ice to be a better hockey player now? Or do you think the off the ice stuff is still the same, and then you're going to teach the rest of it? Or do they need to, like I said, do something maybe different to help that new way of thinking to develop the all around hockey player?
Again, another excellent question. First of all, I don't think kids play enough, just play overall enough. They don't go outside. They don't try to figure things out. They're too institutionalized in a sense. So yeah, I think shooting 100 pucks a day is great, but I think what you should do, instead of taking 100 shots of just this, you do one of this one, then you do one of the other one, then you try to do another one, because we're learning that through studies, scientific studies, that if you mix them up, you will actually retain them better. So I remember one of my sons who ended up playing at UMass Boston, he'd go in the garage and I would hear him doing a play-by-play. So he wasn't just going around cones. He's like, I'm passing to such and such, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing that. So I think that stuff is incredible, because now they're getting their creative, you know, their creative juices going. They're starting to see a game that only they're seeing, and that's great. And so off ice, we all know that the kids who just do it at practice aren't going to be the ones necessarily going to be the most successful. You have to put in the time at home. It's just, how are you doing it? Are you doing something that is totally repetitive? Are you trying to make yourself to repeat each technique perfectly, or are you trying to make those techniques adaptable? And that's where the creativity and the play from the child is going to make the difference to me. If you're trying to make it look perfect, you're never going to have that same situation ever happen again anyway. So let's make it so that it's adaptable. You know, how far my hands, you know, my hands need to be this close, or they need to be this far apart due to the situation that I'm as a child having, you know, playing street hockey. My God, what, you got to move your hands here. You got to move there. You got to, you know, you got to learn how to protect the puck, you know, as opposed to this chase for the ideal technique that does not exist. Because, you know, we always see this, you know, you'll see it on Instagram. This guy's got his ankles at 90, at 45 degrees and this and that. Like, what kid brings a protractor on the ice? You know, it depends on, am I tired? What's the length of my legs? How strong are my legs? You know, those kinds of things. But as parents, we love the other part, because that's telling us exactly what we need to do. But every kid is different. Every situation is different. The ice is different. I'm tired. You know, all those things change. So we have to let our kids do exactly what you said. Stuff at home, but don't make it so regimented that it's taking the joy out of it, or the creativity, or the decision-making out of it. And we can guide them. I'm not saying we just let them do bad things, but then we design a game that's going to help them get back to that technique, but still at the same time making decisions. And we're also then, we're making players that are accountable for their own development, and they also can feel like, it wasn't the coach that made me that player, I made myself that player. And that's something a lot of our kids are missing out on, the feeling that I'm the one responsible. I had a game where we were playing with my 10U team, and I remember telling them at the end of the year, it's a close game, and I said to them, who's in charge on the ice? And all those little 10-year-olds yelled out, we are. And I was like, yeah, I like that. That's pretty cool.
That's a huge win. I mean, that's the one thing that it was uncanny, is that kids will sit and watch the Instagrams and the YouTubes, but how many of them are actually sitting and watching games? That is the big thing there. Like, you know, Gretzky used to hear stories where he would sit and watch a game, and while the game was on, he's literally drawing where the play's going, and he's visualizing without even looking at the paper as to where the play's going. And, you know, we live in an era where you can rewind or go back and see once a goal is scored and take a look and visualize, like, what did you see the player could have done there differently if they didn't score, or when they did score, did you see it? And that was one of the things that, you know, I wish I would have used it a little bit more earlier on, was how many kids are watching the game? Because if you say you want to play it and be great at it, well, you should be watching it at the higher level or any level, right? And love it. But what are you seeing there? Like I said, you know, Jeff and I have been out of the youth level for the last couple of years. Are you seeing a movement where kids are, you know, we know the Instagram's out there, the social media, but are they watching?
They watch highlights.
Yeah.
So they don't see what happened before that. They don't see the mistakes. They don't see the fact that, you know, that player had to try that 500 times before he actually was able to do it. They don't see why the setup was okay this time because he did something the last time. And I think that's unfortunate. I kind of try to say it is, how do you expect a kid to paint the sunrise if they've never seen a sunrise? You know, it's like, obviously, you know, every game situation is different. I remember my kids watching games because they always watch games. And I'd hear my little 10-year-old go, hey, he should have gone over, you know, why did he go there? That guy was wide open. It's like they were starting to see things, you know, as the game progressed, and it helped in their ability to understand the game more. Now, again, obviously you got to go out and play it because you have it, perceiving it by video is not quite the same as being actually in the ice, but it does help. And I think it also gives them, hey, I want to try that. That was pretty neat what he did, you know. But if you just see it in the highlight, it doesn't show what set it up. Like I would always ask my kids when I was coaching them that, why do they call them highlights? And finally we come down to an agreement with the whole team that it's because it doesn't happen very often. So the issue we're having with our players, and you see it in places like Florida, it's not play with the puck, it's play without the puck, which we spend 98% of the game doing. Defensively off the puck, offensively off the puck. How am I influencing play by where I'm going? Everything is centered around the player and the puck themselves. But with the idea that we always thought it was like you're training them in a vacuum. And so watching the games gives them the idea that it's not one individual player. It's how is it all, how do all these chess pieces work together to create these plays?
No, it makes a lot of sense. And it's so important. And we've talked about this for a long time now on the show for the last, you know, 2 years about the social media and everything it brings to you, us included, right? Because of social media and all the connectivity, we are in your ear and on your screen right now, right? We are part of this whole thing. But the downside to that is I grew up watching the game. You know, you're talking about playing roller hockey, doing things on your own and all that. I mean, I was out on the 12-foot wide road with a hill on all three sides of me with the orange ball and rollerblades. You know, this one had three wheels and that one had four, and they were all angled the wrong way because they were worn to no end because I never spun them around, right? But I remember, which is the worst reference because obviously now I know the game way more than then, but I was always Ray Bourque, you know, dangling around, right? What does Ray Bourque really do? Well, he stands on the blue line and fires a slap shot 100 miles an hour, right? That's not what I was doing. So wrong guy, but that's what I was. I was Ray Bourque on my street growing up for a decade by myself for hours on end on nights and weekends. And it didn't get me anywhere. Clearly, Kevin knows exactly how that's a horrible, horrible excuse of a hockey player I am. But still, it's what these kids need to do. And the kids that get out there and can just go learn the game, watch the game, enjoy the game, play other sports that help tie into it, it all matters, Jim. It all matters 100%. And I love the fact that you're promoting the entire package, because so many coaches now, it's, and you see it all again, all over Facebook and all over Instagram, here's my clinic, here's my skill, my shooting clinic, my checking clinic, my skating clinic. And while those are all important for certain level players at certain ages, a 12-year-old going to this clinic today and that clinic tomorrow and that clinic the next day is just making them little hockey robots. And when they get on the ice, they're not the full package, Jim. So I really love what you're doing with that. And I feel like you feel the same way, that the total hockey player needs the total hockey training.
Yeah, I did an internship, a very short, like 4 or 5 day internship with the national development team. And I remember John Hans, who was the coach, said, we want players who can compete and are smart. So that's what we need to be emphasizing. We can do we can work on skating, making them smarter. We can work on stick handling, making them smarter. We can do all that. We just have to decide. And when we think about it, what do all our upper level coaches tell us? Oh, I just wish this kid was smarter. I wish he competed harder. Well, he never had to compete. He never had to make a decision. So can an NHL team get away with doing flow drills? You bet they can. They do them for a totally different reason. They've already had thousands and thousands of hours of making decisions. We're taking that opportunity away from our kids if we don't put them in situations where they make decisions and compete. We're actually robbing them, I feel like. And that's something I've changed as I've gone through over the years. And what I found by watching these practices, a mentor of mine told me, once you see it, you can't unsee it. When you see a kid all of a sudden make a move like, what the hell did he get come up with that idea? It's like, this is like, that's awesome. Because he never, if I try to tell him to do that, if I draw it up on the board, you know, he's not going to do it. And if you ever notice, when a coach does draw things up on a board, and I'm not saying there's not times for everything, the energy of the practice usually goes down, and the coach gets louder trying to push the energy up by telling them where everybody needs to go. You put them in a small area game, the energy is there. You just create a game that's going to fit the learning objective. You don't just play games to play games. You play games to fit a learning objective.
Or you do the 40-second drill and bag skate them, and then that's the end of practice.
Lines, baby, lines.
That's it. Yeah, toes on the lines. But no, you make a great point there, because I'd be growing up, God forbid, you take the puck in front of your own net. You the whole team's going to be skating. But secondly, you're not going to see that ice. And, it's amazing the skill level that I said it earlier. The skill level of these kids is unbelievable. Jeff has heard me say it over the years. It's just the vision and the hockey sense. If there is a way to get that at a younger age for kids to see, which it sounds like now, USA Hockey specifically is investing in that, I can't wait to see what it's going to bring. Because that was the big thing. There's huge athletes out there, but man.
And Kevin, no vision. What we're trying to promote is the idea that there's a difference between technique and skill. Skill is be able to use techniques in a game-like environment. So you can have all the technique in the world, but if you don't know when to do it, you don't know how to use it, then that's really not skillful. So we're trying to change that word. And I know sometimes the words don't, to people that get confused. Well, the fact that, like, for example, the video of Patrick Kane going through all those pucks. Yeah, that's great. But there are kids who are 10 years old who can do that. But what Patrick Kane can do is take that technique and then read off of everything that's going on around him. And that's what makes him skillful. Not just the fact that he can go through those pucks. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. But if we're not having the other thing that goes along with it, that's pushing them into the idea of making decisions, then that becomes something that is not as important as it could be.
Yeah, I can make a 3-footer just like Tiger Woods. I can't make a 30-footer. I can't make a 30-footer like Tiger Woods, right? Like, yeah, exactly. I can't take that skill and make it into something bigger, right? I like to think I can, but we've well established on this show, both of Kevin and my golfing game is nowhere near where it needs to be.
But you've come up the perfect analogy. Like, how often do golfers go to the driving range? The driving range isn't the same as playing the game, because the lie is different. The grass is wetter. The grass is taller. I've only got to hit it 70 yards, not as hard as I can, because it's going to look good. Because a lot of guys go to the driving range, you look fantastic, but you can't play the game because you don't know how to adjust it to the actual environment of the game itself.
That's my problem right there. Jim just solved my golf game. One sentence right there.
Well, mine just, I'm just bad. That's my golf problem.
Driving range? What? No, I don't need a perfect lie, because I'm never in a perfect lie.
So, Jim, before we let you go, I do want to just hear how tryouts have been. So for those of you listening or watching, we're recording the show on the Thursday, May 8th. Some tryouts are still going on in certain rinks. TBSA may still be having some for TBHC. But what have you seen so far this week? And don't give away the farm. Don't sell the trade secrets to the other organizations, Jim. But how has tryouts been?
Yeah, we had about 460 kids come to tryouts. I mean, it was a lot of good players. You know, the same thing as everybody else knows, you never know who's going to sign until they sign. You know, kids are trying out here and there. They're trying to go to whatever the parents think is the best environment for them. It's nice to see that many players, and I'm sure a lot of the other organizations have seen the same thing, so there's more players available. I think the level of players are getting better year after year. I hate tryout week because I hate seeing kids get disappointed. To me, that rips my heart out. And I can luckily say that there's been some coaches I've talked to who've had the same thing. And when they say that to me, say, I'm glad you're coaching, because if it didn't hurt you, I wouldn't want you to be coaching anymore. So that's the toughest part. I also think one of the things I would say to parents sometimes is don't always chase what the best team is. If you're getting recruited real hard, then the chances are they're going to recruit a kid next year just as hard as you to replace you. If coaches are there to develop you, and sometimes a great player is a great coach, sometimes they're not. And sometimes, you know, myself, I sit there and I study coaching 2 or 3 hours a day. That's what my job lets me do. So that might not be as good a player as such and such, but I come with a different thing. But you just have to find, what does an association stand for? Does that fit into what you want as a family? And then hopefully the both of you line up. But it's a horrible week. I hate seeing kids feel bad. It rips my heart out. It really does.
Jim, worst part ever. Yeah. There's a lot of times where when I was the head coach, I was like, just pick the team and I'll come in afterwards and, coach them from there. Cause I can't voice that more than anything, specifically down here, right? Where, you know, the tryouts, there's to me not enough time to really see, specifically as the kids get older too, you know, an hour here or an hour there. What I would love to see is what I grew up is, you know, other clubs would play other clubs during tryout week. And that was part of, you know, who you felt was going to make the A team or the B team type of deal. That means that, you know, people don't have to chase the letter or the record. They've got to be committed to, you know, the club that they're wanting to play with. But really, that would be, if I could see that down here during tryout week, it would be fantastic. Because again, you're going from seeing kids do, you know, skating to an hour of, if you've got 30 kids on each bench, how do you know who's just having an off day? And, you know, that was my biggest challenge. You know, we talked about it on previous episodes where, you know, some of the kids, but the ones that are coming up from rec or the ones that just moved to the area, I'd love to see them, you know, all the kids have another opportunity. So, yep, I agree.
And I truly wish we did it like Texas, where we had AA tryouts 1 week and then A tryouts the next week. That way the kids who, because you're seeing kids who don't make your A team go, or they make your A team, then they go run to play on a AA team because, and I'm not blaming anybody for doing whatever, but I think that would make it easier on the organizations. And I think it would actually be less stressful for the kids because, you know, okay, they already know the AA teams are picked. So there's not this, you know, now I'm going to go out and try at this level. And I think it'd make it easier for associations, because I've had kids who are like, at different times I've been coaching, they're seventh or eighth on my list or further down, and they leave to go play for a AA team. It's like,
yeah,
okay. You weren't even necessarily high on my A team, you know, but, and it just makes it hard. Then, you know, some kid doesn't make your team. And so then because some other kid leaves for a AA team and now you're calling them afterwards and they feel like an afterthought. It's really tough, but I really do think if we did it AA 1 week, A the next week, that would alleviate a big problem that we have right now.
I agree with that completely. It's the tier one, tier two model expanded to include tier two, you know, in its entirety, right? And who knows, maybe we'll get there, right? We've got the Seehoff board is, you know, per their announcement, they're going to be looking, it sounds like, to do a whole new Seehoff board, and then they're going to have the SFHL board. Maybe all the new blood or new ideas or a new outlook on the future of Florida hockey brings some of these changes to the forefront, or at least brings people in the room that are willing to have these conversations in earnest and think about what we can do. Because I think at the end of the day, the more fresh ideas, fresh eyes, fresh blood, I'll even say it a little, maybe a step back from connection. A lot of people are connected. They're on the boards because they're connected to organizations or running organizations. And again, I'm not saying it's as a negative, it's factual. You've got hockey directors and league directors on the boards making decisions for it creates just naturally a conflict of interest. And again, I'm not passing judgment as it's a negative. It is factual. And I think you limit ideas when it's the same people talking to the same people. It's that echo chamber. And I think we need to get out of that in Florida hockey. And Jim, you have a lot of experience and you are absolutely not repeating the echo chamber. And I appreciate that. And I think in the future, that's what the state of Florida needs to grow the game of hockey. Cause if Kevin and I have one thing we can really, stand proud for is that we are all about growing the game and producing the athlete and the love of the game into the youth and really doing our little part, I guess, to push that forward. And Jim, you're doing your part much bigger and much more important than we are. And on behalf of Kevin, I know he feels the same way, but we appreciate what you do. And we really thank you for taking the time to talk with us tonight on the podcast, buddy. Really had a good conversation. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I just love talking hockey. I think you can tell I don't shut up about it. So I really enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
We need more people like you. That's the thing. Hey, it's volunteerism first and, it's taking your personal time and, to do it and do it well, it takes that time. So I voice just what Jeff said. I know he was speaking on my behalf, but thank you so much for what you do and continue to grow the game. It's a great game. I love to see what's coming out of the state of Florida. And I think it's just the beginning. We're going to see more and more talent, whether it's in the NHL or, on the world stage playing over in Europe. It's going to be fun to watch.
Agreed. Jim, putting you on the spot, do you have a way too early pick for the Stanley Cup champion this season?
Honestly, I think Dallas might be unstoppable. I mean, when Heiskanen gets back, the fact that they're playing that well without him is pretty scary.
I agree.
I would agree too. Kevin, I don't need to hear from you. You just be quiet over there, buddy.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree with Dallas. But Dad, don't worry. I'm still going blue and white, bud. We
absolutely
got this.
For sure. Again, that's the end of the hockey talk, the NHL talk for the day. Jim, again, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It was great hearing your experience, your thoughts, and the way you're doing it because you're doing it the right way. So appreciate it for sure. Kevin, enjoy the weekend. You got a little festivities afoot on the golf course, so you'll be in the perfect lie all weekend, buddy. Nail that 3-footer every chance you get.
Foot wedge, and hey, more importantly to all the mothers out there, right? It's Mother's Day weekend. We know as hockey players, you can't do it without the moms. They are the drivers a lot of times, both in behind the scenes and getting kids to the rink. I know my mom did her fair share of road work back in the day. So yeah, happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day. Great, great, great way to end it, Kevin. Appreciate it. Again, Jim, thank you. Kevin, thank you. Everyone else, we'll see you next time in the nest. Cheers.